The following presentation is distributed by St. Paul Street Evangelization, a grassroots nonprofit Catholic evangelization organization dedicated to responding to the mandate of Jesus to preach the gospel to all nations by taking our Catholic faith to the streets. To listen to more talks, to learn more about faith in Jesus or the Catholic Church, or to order materials, go to www.streetevangelization.com. And now, our feature presentation.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? 1-800-585-9396. What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Welcome back to Call to Communion here on EWTN, the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. We'd love to hear from you if you have a question about the Catholic faith. I'm Tom Price, along with our host for Call to Communion, Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Couldn't be better. What's new with you, brother?
Well, you know, a lot of reasons to be Catholic.
Yes.
All right, a lot of reasons to be Catholic. One of them, Catholicism includes a philosophy. It's not only a philosophy, but it has a philosophy, and it's the philosophy of common sense. It's the philosophy that says eggs are eggs. Now, before we got on the show, I was telling you about a conversation I had with somebody in a public place today.
Yeah, tell us a little about that. I think the audience would appreciate it.
You know, we kind of got into this whole issue of gender and politics and identity and all these kinds of issues.
And this was a total stranger,
that
came up to you.
Walked up to me, approached me, because I was having a conversation with my daughter. You know, and it boiled down to whether or not it was correct or incorrect to refer to people in terms that reflected the objective reality of their biology. Like, you know, my daughter's pretty unambiguously female. Would it be wrong to say she's a girl? And this person took the position that that was wrong, that you shouldn't address people and say you're a girl, you're a boy, or whatever, that there's not a fact of the matter. And so I said, pointed to my car. I said, this is a car. It's not a cheetah. Now, the interesting thing is my interlocutor, my conversation partner, wouldn't concede the point that my car was not a cheetah.
That's an amazing thing.
Yeah,
so there is no absolute truth.
There's no objective reality. You know, and I pointed to my daughter and I said, this is a girl. And the person I was speaking to said, I don't know that. I don't know
that. Wow.
And at that point I said, you know, I think that your ideology has overrun your intellect. Your ideology has overrun your intellect.
Now, how does she handle that? Because that's kind of right out there.
Right, yeah, it is. I think where she was coming from is interesting. Her position was that you ought to construct definitions and language not based on necessarily what's objectively true about the world, but in a way that would essentially make nobody feel excluded, right? That exclusion was the ultimate evil. And so we ought to define things in ways that would obviate that evil. And so, you know, I pointed out, well, you know, not everybody has legs. You know, people amputees, all right? Of course, you know, they're excluded from, you know, field hockey.
Okay.
You know,
all
as
right.
a result, okay? And yes, I mean, this is somebody who has a disability, somebody who has a difficulty, you know, lacks something that they would otherwise be due, you know, due to their former essence. That constitutes for them a hardship. So we can treat them with dignity and love and respect.
Of course.
And, you know, everything. Just like you would anybody who might fall into one of these sort of politically correct categories, treat them with love and dignity and respect. That doesn't mean that it's necessary for us to say of them, you know, you are fundamentally not, well, what you fundamentally are just because you say otherwise. And I gave the illustration. I said, you know, if I came to you and said I was Napoleon, I'm Napoleon. And yeah. Maybe there's a genetic basis for my saying I'm Napoleon. Maybe, you know, I have some chemical whatever that causes me to be somewhat psychotic, and I think I'm Napoleon. You
okay.
don't have a duty, a moral obligation to affirm that I'm Napoleon, because I'm not Napoleon. There's an objective fact of the matter. I happen to be David, not Napoleon.
I'm glad to hear you clarify that,
yeah.
at least.
All so right. anyway, you know, the Catholic Church is not the only entity in the world that affirms that reality is real, right, that objective norms exist, that there's a fact of the matter, but it does embrace,
it does.
You know, the philosophy that says eggs are eggs.
We got a prayer request, which we take very seriously around here. Here is his prayer request. He says, I have received several urgent requests from good Catholics in Ireland pleading for prayers and help for this Friday's constitutional referendum to redefine marriage. 3 months ago, the polls showed 80% in favor of redefining marriage. Now, the recent poll shows it is now too close to call. He says, I know how busy you are. This comes very late, but if there's anything you could do, I'm sure the Catholic people of Ireland would be very grateful, as am I.
You know, Tom, when I listen to that, one of the things that comes to my mind is we can't fall into the trap of thinking that moral realities are simply whatever we legislate them to be.
Yeah.
We attempt to mold our legislation as a society to reflect moral realities. We don't create moral realities through our laws. We try to reflect those. And what's the reality here that we're trying to protect in law? Something that's been recognized since the dawn of time, as long as there have been human beings, as long as there have been men and women, and that is that when men and women get together in intimate union, that babies happen. And there's a moral reality that comes into existence. Father, mother, child. Parents have a moral obligation to the child. The child has certain claims on the moral life of the parents. And the social recognition of that fact is what we call marriage. And every society since the dawn of time has had some form of marriage recognizing, not creating, but recognizing the moral reality of parenthood. That's what it's all about. And when you attempt to devalue that in legislation and to strip from parents their legal rights in their children or the children's right to their parents, it's ultimately children that will suffer.
Yeah, and as we have said a number of times, every child deserves a mother and a father.
Absolutely. You can have really loving people, but a man cannot be a mother and a woman cannot be a father.
Yeah.
It's a metaphysical impossibility, and a child needs both a mother and a father.
Got an email here from Puerto Rico. If we're all made in God's image, why are some born gay? Now, my second question is, what can I tell my nephew, who is 16? He said he's gay and that he feels that he has not been good to God by being that way. These are the reasons he gives me every time I tell him he needs to get back to church. Again, that's from Wilfredo.
First of all, I'd like to say that this is not a settled thing to assume that people are born gay. To be sure, there are people who are homosexual. There are people who may not even be able to give an account of their homosexual inclinations.
Mm-hmm.
That's far from demonstrating that there's some kind of genetic predisposition to homosexuality.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not an expert in the psychology or the genetics of the thing, but my understanding is things like twin studies suggest that there's not a genetic predisposition to homosexuality. Now, that being said, even if there were, and I'm not saying there is, but even if there were, mm-hmm. it wouldn't change the moral realities, because all of us deal with passions, not just sexual passion, but, you know, they could be, appetites, irascible passions, anger, impatience, all kinds of passions that in themselves are morally neutral, and they take on moral significance when they engage our reason and our will. So some people may have a genetic, even, predisposition to a particular passion, which, if indulged indiscriminately, could actually lead to moral consequences. All right, you know,
yeah.
I myself have a passion for food and drink. I mean, that's it's a real strong temptation for me to kind of, you know, jump in with both feet, as it were, and go overboard. Is that genetic, or did I get it from my gastronomically, you know, celebratory family? I don't know where I got it from. It doesn't matter. I just know that I have this predisposition.
I see food
and I'm going for
all
it,
right.
You know. Now, the question about your nephew, when the church sees someone that has this condition of homosexual inclination, the immediate response is not one of judgment. Far from it. It's one of compassion. I just encountered a fellow yesterday, in fact, who, in his case, his predisposition, his inclination to homosexuality was not because of genetics. It was because of neglect and abuse and sexual abuse in his past, in particular situation with his father. And when he came of age into sexual maturity, he was a deeply wounded person who had a very strong desire for affection from men because of what he had been deprived of in childhood.
I see.
So he got into the homosexual lifestyle because of these sort of deep wounds in his person.
Yeah.
And that may not be everybody, but that was his situation.
Uh-huh.
So you look at people and you have a deep compassion and a mercy for them because of their wounds and their needs and so forth. And that's the church's attitude. If you read the Catechism of the Catholic Church on homosexuality, it approaches it in exactly this way, that these are wounded people who lack something that's due to them in nature, namely a sexual inclination ordered to the procreation of children, the good of their spouse, and so forth. Not something to condemn them for, something to love and help them show mercy. Now, what we do need to say is that when people give themselves over to that disordered inclination, it can lead to real harm, and that is a moral evil. All right, and it needs to be resisted, but in an attitude of love and patience and mercy and kindness and compassion, and a realism about how difficult it can be.
Hello, Amy. What's your question today?
Why doesn't the Catholic Church allow gay couples to marry?
Okay, I really appreciate the question, Amy. Thank you so much. And I think there's a good bit of confusion on this topic in the general public. The question itself, I think, expresses a certain degree of confusion over what we mean by the term marriage, right? Because when you ask what is marriage in both in Catholic theology as well as the whole history of the human race going back, you know, to time immemorial, marriage is that institution where society or the church comes together to hallow the process of the creation of families and the replenishment of society through childbirth. Why does an institution like marriage exist in every corner of the world? It's because when men and women come together in intimate union, children are the result, and children have extraordinary needs. They're very, very vulnerable, and they have a claim, a very immediate claim on the love, affection, and protection of their parents. And because of that, parents also have rights and duties and obligations to their children. So marriage is the institution that all peoples throughout the world have come to recognize that is there specifically to care for and nurture that relationship of parent and child in the reality of the male-female procreative union. Now, there's some confusion because I think in the West, especially, you know, just in the last century, people have come to believe that any intimate union between two people or any promise to live together under one roof or to share a bank account or all these kinds of things, that that's what constitutes marriage. The essence of marriage is essentially the desire to associate in some sort of, you know, familiar union with a person, you know, for sexual and non-sexual purposes, distinct from its real foundation in the replenishment of society and the procreation of children and parenthood. All right. So because that's what marriage means, it's about where children come from and who has the responsibility to care for them. Asking the question, why can't a homosexual man marry another homosexual man, is a little bit like asking, why can't you have a square circle? What you're talking about two gay people, two homosexual people who are making some sort of pledge of fidelity to one another and living in sexual intimacy. That's just not what the church means by marriage. It's not what traditional society throughout the world, Catholic or non-Catholic, has ever meant by the term. There have been societies where homosexuality was more or less tolerated, where there may or may not even have been legal strictures either forbidding or protecting that union, like pederasty in ancient Greece, for instance. But nobody, even in cultures that tolerated homosexuality, ever made the mistake of confusing mere sexual intimacy with what we're talking about, which is where do children come from and who has the rights and responsibilities of caring for them. And I think one of the most pernicious aspects about the so-called gay marriage debate in the West is when you frame the way it's been framed in our culture, it's that any two people who have the desire to live together in intimacy therefore incur the right dictated by the state that they should be able to go out and adopt some other man's children, some other woman's children, and have them deeded to them in essence by the state. Because, of course, homosexual unions are infertile. Only way they can have children, unless they, you know, sort of go looking elsewhere, is to adopt them from somebody else, which would seem to imply that the care and protection of children is something that's not derived from the essence of the human person and the male-female union, but something that's rather awarded by the state. And that's a really frightening view of parenthood and childhood. This is not something that's intrinsic to my person through my generative capacities, but something that's granted to me by an omnicompetent legislative authority, a sort of, you know, governmental diktat. That's quite frightening.
Does that make sense to you, Amy?
Yes, but for some reason I'm concerned about, you know, the couples who want their unions blessed by God, you know, so how come they can't have that? Like, it doesn't seem fair to me.
Okay, well, first of all, keep in mind, there's no barrier. A homosexual man, given the understanding of marriage that the church articulates, there's nothing stopping a homosexual man from marrying a woman. That's what marriage means. It's a man and a woman coming together to have children. So there's no law in the church that says gay people can't marry. Marriage means a man and a woman coming together to build a family. And there are a lot of homosexual people who are married to members of the opposite sex, and they have children, they build families. Now, you know, the Catechism of the Catholic Church recognizes that if a person has, you know, very strong, deep-seated same-sex attraction, that poses a trial and a difficulty to them in living the married life. We all have trials and difficulties. Marriage is not easy for anybody, gay or straight. Right. So it's not like marriage is denied to homosexual persons. They're allowed to marry. Marriage means find somebody of the opposite sex, have babies with them, and raise them in a family. That's what marriage means. Gay people aren't denied that. They just face some particularly difficult challenges. You know, for whatever reason, wherever those inclinations or attractions come from, they do pose a barrier to living out that that vocation of parenthood that we're all, you know, that those of us who, you know, are called to live out as parents have to face, all right? But as to why the church wouldn't bless the sexual union of a man and a man, or the sexual union of a woman and a woman, because that goes quite contrary to the purposes of human sexuality, which is intrinsically procreative. I mean, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to understand that the reason we have a sexual faculty at all is so that we can give birth, so that we can generate children and raise them in families. When we take that sexuality outside the context of marriage and family, all kinds of difficulties and absurdities and even severe moral problems are incurred, such as I mentioned earlier, radical confusion about the relationship of father, mother, child, family, and who has the right to raise children and the duty. You know, in France, the way this debate has been framed, and I think it's very, very helpful, is the question, do children deserve a mother and a father? Do children deserve a mother and a father? And as soon as you pose the question, any sensible person, I think, can realize, yes, absolutely, the children have a right. Children have a right to have an intimate relationship of protection and love and nurture with their biological parents. That's due in nature, right? And the whole dynamic of the gay marriage debate ignores the rights of children, the intrinsic natural rights of children to their parents. So if we were to give government or church sanction to homosexual unions as somehow morally equivalent of the male-female procreative union we call family, the results in the life of the child would be extraordinarily deleterious, harmful.
Let's go to Elizabeth in Michigan. Hey there, Elizabeth. What's your question today?
Well, with all the confusion in the church today, our archbishop heroically came out and asked all those who believed in gay marriage to refrain from Holy Communion. And yet I have heard people say, well, Rome hasn't come out to say that. So who do we follow when a bishop is saying one thing and yet Rome has not come out with a definitive statement? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I would appreciate the call a lot, Elizabeth. And a number of things to say here. First of all, it is just flat out wrong to assert that Rome has not spoken definitively on the nature of Christian marriage. I mean, I could hardly think of a doctrine that they've explicated more precisely and in more detail and more dogmatically more times throughout the history of the Catholic faith than the nature of marriage. You know, I mean, if you go back to Leo XIII's encyclical Arcanum, or Pius XI's Casti Connubii, or more recently John Paul II in his post-synodal exhortation Familiaris Consortio, I mean, you could go on and on, or Paul VI in Humana Vitae and the nature of human sexuality. I mean, you could go on and list magisterial statement after magisterial statement after magisterial statement on the nature of Christian marriage and natural marriage. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, of course, has a lengthy section on the sacrament of matrimony and natural marriage as well. You know, think about what John Paul II gave the Church in his own theological reflection on the theology of the body, or what he wrote when he was Archbishop of Krakow, his work on love and responsibility. I mean, we could just go on all afternoon about Catholic teaching on marriage. And so it's just flat out wrong to assert that Rome hasn't taught definitively on this subject. And the definitive teaching is grounded not only in human reason, but also in the teaching of Christ, who in Matthew 19 said, in the beginning, God created them male and female, and what God, so let the two become one flesh, and what God has joined, let no man separate. So the teaching on marriage is grounded in Holy Scripture, it's grounded in human reason, and the whole patrimony of the human race, and confirmed by the magisterium again and again and again for 2,000 years. So that's just flat out wrong. You know, in terms of refraining from Holy Communion, that's interesting. You know, the Church imposes an automatic excommunication, actually, for people who are manifest heretics. It doesn't have to be imposed by a bishop's decree. It's just automatic, you know, as I understand it. Canon lawyers, don't jump on me too bad if I mistake something. And Canon 751 of the Code defines heresy this way. Heresy is the obstinate denial or obstinate doubt after the reception of baptism of some truth which is to be believed by divine and Catholic faith. All right, so that's what a heretic is. Somebody who understands quite clearly what the teaching of the church is, mm-hmm. what their moral obligation is to believe it, and then obstinately, and the key word there is obstinately refuses to believe it. Now, you know, I would never say of any individual Catholic, I know that that person is a heretic, because I don't know the extent of, you know, how well do they understand the teaching? You know, how obstinate is their refusal? And I think, unfortunately, many people have a very, very shallow grasp on what the church teaches about marriage and human sexuality. And frankly, I've met Catholics who know more about the church from, you know, secular media sound bites than they actually do, yeah. you know, directly from the mouth of their bishop or from the Pope.
Let's go to Tara in Scranton, PA, listening on FM 98.9. Hey there, Tara, what's your question today?
I have a question. Yeah. I have a person who's a neighbor of mine, and he is a homosexual.
Okay.
And he's a very good and moral person. And it just bothers me that as a Catholic, I have to look at him a certain way, even though I know that he is very generous, very moral, and very good. And I really feel that he doesn't choose to be this way, that he was made this way.
Okay. All right. I really appreciate that, Tara. And I'd like to offer a couple of thoughts of maybe some clarification, if I might. All right. So the Catholic Church does not say that he is a bad person in his sexual orientation. What the Catholic Church says is that any part of our humanity, whether we take our sexuality, our biological functions, our mental functions, our rational functions,
yeah.
they exist to serve a purpose. And they can do so effectively or less effectively through absolutely no moral fault of our own. So to take an analogy, eyes exist for seeing. I don't think there's any dispute about that. And someone that comes into the world, you know, with one eye or damaged vision or blindness or something is not a bad person because their eyes don't function precisely as they are designed to function to fulfill this purpose of seeing. In the same way, we have our rationality so that we can know truth, all right, and know the truth about things. And some people have an incredible gift in utilizing that rationality in sublime and amazing ways. Other people, through no fault of their own, may have suppressed mental function. All right, they may have some kind of developmental disability. There's no moral fault that attaches to that whatsoever at all. In the same way, our sexuality exists, and this is just at the biological level. It's pretty obvious why we have sexuality. Our sexuality exists for the sake of procreation. It comes with all kinds of ancillary benefits in addition to procreation, namely pleasure.
Sure.
And, you know, the unitive bond that can come to exist between people and families and tenderness and affection and love
all
and
that.
All these kinds of things. But functionally, it's there for the sake of procreation.
Correct.
Now, just like our eyesight exists for seeing and our minds for knowing mm-hmm. and our sexuality for procreating, there can come along deficiencies in the order of that capacity, of that function, that deflect it somewhat from its fullest expression to achieve the purpose for which it exists. So somebody might have some deficiency in their sexuality for reasons they might be genetic. I don't know. I'm not competent to make that argument. They might be cultural. They might be because of conditioning. They might be because of experiences they had in childhood. Doesn't really matter. So that their sexuality is deflected away from that natural end of procreation. Unless somebody decided to willfully turn their inclination that way, there's no moral fault attached to that whatsoever at all. Just like there's no moral fault attached to, you know, to blindness or missing a limb or whatever. All right. Now, there would be a moral fault. Take the analogy of seeing again. There would be a moral fault if I said, you know what, blindness isn't a moral fault, so I'm going to go make somebody blind. Well, that would be a moral fault. Or
yeah.
if I said blindness isn't bad, so I'm going to make myself blind. If I intentionally blinded myself, or if I intentionally dampened my own rationality through, you know, drug abuse or something like that, that would be a moral fault, because in my rationality, I can know what the purpose of this function is. I can know why it exists and how to best use it to bring my body and my life and my person to the greatest fruition. So in the same way, someone who says, I know why I have sexuality for procreation and also for intimacy and family building and things like that. If I take that sexuality and I deliberately distort it and use it in a capacity that is harmful of those natural ends, then I have done something immoral. And that's not just homosexuality. It could also include
adultery
and fornication, all kinds of things that can deflect from the natural end of the natural good of families. Mm-hmm. All right. Then it is morally blameworthy. I have homosexual friends, know a lot of homosexual people. When I engage with a homosexual person in conversation or whatever, I don't assume they're a bad person. I assume they're a person who has this natural capacity that's been deflected for some reason from its natural and good end. There's no moral blame attached to that at all, and I regard them as I would anybody that's suffering from some deficiency, and there is a deficiency there, with compassion and mercy and
sure,
love.
Still
and so
a child
forth.
Of
now,
God.
Now, that's different when somebody takes that situation they're in and then adopts say for instance, an ideological agenda that makes of that deficiency a kind of moral virtue, and then intends to go live in a way that is destructive of the natural good of families and relationships and children and all that, then that is morally problematic. And that's not being homosexual. That can, you know, become the sin of sodomy or the sin of false mm-hmm. teaching and so mm-hmm. forth. Then I am engaging in something that's morally problematic.
Let's go now to Jim in West Virginia, listening on FM 89.7. Hey there, Jim. What's your question today?
I was just curious. There was a study years ago, and it was at the Chicago Diocese, and they interviewed the priest and asked him how many of them were gay, were homosexual, and what exactly is the church's stance on that?
Okay, I really appreciate the question. A couple things there. First of all, Pope Benedict issued a document during his pontificate indicating that even celibate and chaste homosexual men should not be admitted to Catholic seminaries, even if they were following the church's moral teaching, because part of the job of a priest is to model authentic masculinity, and same-sex attraction is a deformation. It's of the natural sexual inclination, and so at least in that respect of their persons, they don't model authentic human sexuality or authentic masculinity. So it's not appropriate for a person with a deep-seated homosexual attraction to be admitted to the Catholic priesthood. Not that homosexual people are incapable of serving in a pastoral role. Of course they're capable, but they don't model that authentic masculinity. Of course, also in North America at this time, having deep same-sex attraction is often very much associated with a particular subculture that does not embrace the church's moral teaching, and that's even more problematic, far more problematic, if you have someone that not only suffers from same-sex attraction, but also positively rejects the church's moral teaching and embraces the so-called gay lifestyle or gay subculture. That's very, very problematic and is associated with much higher rates of abuse and that sort of thing. So for these kinds of reasons, the Pope said, no, this is not an appropriate situation for somebody entering the Catholic priesthood. Now, in terms of why then are there some practicing homosexuals within the Catholic priesthood? Well, to be sure, the willingness of a particular diocese to enforce the church's rules on this varies from diocese to diocese. You have certain places where the culture in the seminary or the hierarchy is more or less supportive of that. And then you have people that are dishonest about their motives for entering the priesthood. You know, it's true in schools and other institutions that some people hide aspects of their character because they're looking for opportunities to act in ways that are contrary to the natural good of the human person. Mm-hmm. And as you put, they may actually use the priesthood or the school classroom or whatever else as an excuse to or an opportunity to indulge that. Of course, that's very, very inappropriate, very wrong, very sinful. Church takes a very firm hand with that, very dim view of that. In terms of, you know, sexual abuse that's happened of minors in the past, since that has come to light, of course, in the last 20 years or so, the church has taken a lot of steps to clean that up, to put barriers in place, to make that much harder to do, to hold not only priests but also bishops accountable, to follow the church's moral teaching, not to reassign priests that have been abusers. And I also think it's helpful to put it in perspective. Whatever the rates of sexual fidelity or infidelity are within the clergy, rates of childhood sexual abuse in the Catholic Church are not higher than they are in analogous institutions in the popular culture, whether they be schools or other denominations or other religions. the rates of abuse among Catholic clergy are not higher than they are of public school teachers, for instance. I know I quoted on the show yesterday a study by Hofstra University scholar Carol Shakeshaft, who argued that the rate of child sexual abuse in the California public schools, for instance, was 100 times higher than that which is in the Catholic Church. But it doesn't get as much airplay, doesn't get as much coverage in the popular media because the California public school is not as much of a target for that sort of thing, you know, for public scrutiny as the church is.
John in South Carolina, listening to us on AM 730. Hey, John, what's your question today?
I'm calling because I was curious just regarding the Catholic Church's stance on homosexuality and same-sex marriages, transgender, lesbian, things like that. And it seems like they've taken the stance that they're against it, and the Bible says that it's not appropriate.
Okay, thank you so much, John. I really appreciate the question. It's a very, very important topic. One thing that you pointed out was you referenced the Bible. And, of course, Catholics believe the Bible. Bible's the Catholic book. I mean, the Catholic Church gave the world the Bible, treats it as the inspired Word of God, believes it to be the inspired Word of God. But it would be a mistake to think that the only reason the Catholic Church objects to homosexual practice, all right, as opposed to the condition that we would call same-sex attraction, you know, the inclination or tendency toward same-sex attraction, we can distinguish that from a person who engages in homosexual acts like sodomy, all right? The reason the church objects to sodomy or sodomical acts is not simply because those things are condemned in sacred scripture, which they are. In fact, if you go and find, you can go search through the philosophical, religious, cultural, legal patrimony of the human race and find that throughout the cultures of the world, there has been an understanding about the nature and ends of human sexuality that has ethical implications for the use of one's sexual faculties and of same-sex attraction. So this is not something that's unique to Catholicism. This is really kind of common to the human cultural ethical reflection of the human race. When we begin to start messing with our understanding of the moral realities of parenthood and childhood and assigning them arbitrarily to other types of unions, all right, so, you know, if society comes by and says, you know what, we want to ascribe all of the rights and privileges and obligations of, you know, quote-unquote marriage to football teams, all right, that we think football teams ought to have the same rights and privileges arbitrarily of parents because we really like football, and some people have a very strong inclination to play football, and their inclination to play football may, in fact, overwhelm their inclination to engage in heterosexual sexual activity. Well, why should we discriminate against football players? Let's start letting them adopt children, give them inheritance rights and hospital visitation and everything else that goes along with society's promotion of marriage. And aren't you just discriminating against football players if you don't do so? All right. That line of reasoning is patently absurd because it severs the football teams don't by nature produce babies. And so they don't need the kinds of protections, rights and privileges and obligations that emerge from the sexual union of a man and a woman. And it's no prejudice against football teams if we deny them that place in our culture, right? So that's the way the conversation has to be framed. That's the way we have to understand it. When we take those sexual faculties and use them outside of that context of family and marriage, the results can be quite catastrophic for the family and for children in particular. So it's really with an eye to the whole institution of family, childhood, child rearing, and the moral realities of parenthood. And this is something, again, we say we don't just get this from scripture. We get this from philosophical reflection on the nature of the human person, as is witnessed by the entire history of the human race. Messing with that institution is very, very ethically dangerous for society.
Hey there, Cynthia. What's your question today?
My question is, can I call myself Catholic and say that I love my Catholic faith, but do not believe that I need to go to Mass, don't need to honor the Lord by just going to Mass? That's not the only way you can honor the Sabbath. And I don't really believe in all the authority of the Church, and I now believe not only in just supporting gay unions, but gay marriage. Is that, I just don't know how to address that because that's what's happening in my family.
Okay.
We're cradle Catholics, and I just am so upset the way the it seems to be mainly the 30 to 40, 20 to 40 group that is beginning to be so tolerant and saying, you know, God, they use the issue of, I mean, that God loves us all. He created us. I believe that gays are born, that, you know, all those things. And that's what was the response when I questioned why, what about your Catholic faith? It was, I love my Catholic faith, but I don't need to go to church. You don't need to ask me about it. You need to, that kind of thing.
So this is, okay. So this is not something that you're talking about yourself. You're talking about members of your family.
No, I'm just making it in the first person because I just don't understand that,
that mindset.
It was my child, adult. It was an adult child now, who went all through Catholic school and is now living in a very liberal place.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. This is a difficult situation. It's only going to become more difficult for a lot of people in our culture because these kinds of questions are coming up more and more often, obviously, and it can be an occasion of deep suffering for the people involved, for the families, people themselves, and confusion about their Catholic identity, their sexuality, their moral life. The Church is tremendously compassionate, and if you read the Catechism of the Catholic Church when it deals with homosexuality, for instance, it approaches the homosexual person with great love and tenderness and compassion.
That's right.
You and I have a lot of homosexual friends, some of them Catholic homosexual friends.
Yeah.
And this is, the Catechism speaks about issues with sexuality can be an occasion of deep suffering in a person's life. It's hard to integrate our sexuality, whether we're gay or straight or whatever else, this is one of the areas in life when people, I think, are most keenly aware of their own woundedness, of their own weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
And the Church approaches that with great realism and a great deal of compassion. Right now, that being said, I think it's one thing to talk about the compassion and the love that we owe to homosexual persons, but it's another thing to get into the why does the Church teach what it teaches about the nature of marriage, for instance. There are some things that get overlooked in a lot of the media coverage and the hoopla and the ideology about gay marriage. Ultimately, the Church's concern is for the well-being of children. I mean, if you think about what is the institution of marriage? When we talk about marriage, what are we talking about? Why does marriage exist? Not just in the Catholic Church, but throughout all of human culture and history, back to the dawn of time, everywhere throughout the world. I've studied this question sociologically to some extent. I think there's only one culture in all of human history that didn't make marriage the foundation of the society. All right, so it is just about ubiquitous, even outside the Catholic Church. Why is that the case? All right, as soon as you pose the question, the answer is obvious. When men and women get together in an intimate union, babies happen. When babies come into the world, they're vulnerable and needy for a long time. And by their very existence, they make an immediate moral claim on the people that brought them into the world. All right, somebody has to care for them, somebody has to raise them, somebody has to teach them. The people most capable and responsible for that are their biological parents, their mother and their father. Nobody comes in the world any other way.
Amen.
All right. Now, whatever we may think about sexuality and human attraction and all these kinds of questions, the fundamental reality that babies come when men and women get together is why there is an institution that we call marriage, because there are moral realities there that exist. The parent's obligation to their child, the child's need for their parents, the father's obligation to the mother's obligation to the father, those are moral realities that exist regardless of culture, regardless of law, regardless of custom, regardless of liturgy. They will exist, in Massachusetts, they will exist in California, they will exist in Alabama. It doesn't matter what any court or any legislature says or does, or what they call the word marriage. The moral reality of mother, father, child can never change because it's inscribed into the very nature of the human person's biology. That's the way it is. Marriage, historically, is simply humankind's recognition of the moral realities of parenthood. That's why it exists. We had a major revolution, intellectually, culturally, in the West in the last 100 years, where people began to think that the principal end of marriage was for men and women to gain personal satisfaction by entering into a romantic relationship, and that children were kind of ancillary or secondary to the primary end, which was either my sexual gratification or my romantic interest. Tellingly, as soon as that shift happened, people began to demand the right to divorce. And then they began to demand the right to redefine the institution around whatever their sexual proclivities might be. All right. But that's not why marriage exists. So whatever the reality of whether somebody is born with a homosexual inclination or not, none of that is relevant to the underlying question, do we need to privilege the man-woman-child relationship that is of necessity tied up with the whole process of the replenishment of society and human procreation, all right? And it, when you say not, when you say no, we need to redefine the institution around people's sexual interests or proclivities because they're born this way or whatever, what you've really done is separate marriage from the institution of parenthood, and you've deprived children intrinsically of their right to a mother and a father. And the social cost, the moral cost on kids is enormous. There's an interesting testimony to this fellow by the name of Robert Lopez, I think, who was a man raised by two women who were in a homosexual relationship. Mm-hmm. Has an article out in the most recent edition of First Things, I believe.
Okay.
Talking about his experience. A woman by the name of Dawn Stefanowitz, who a woman raised by a homosexual man in homosexual relationships. Both of them loved their gay parents, all right, very, very much, have a lot of affection for them, and yet they both suffered, and they described their experiences. What is it like if you're a child and you're deprived of your parents? Because you're going to be deprived of at least one. What are the costs to you morally, psychologically, interiorly? And they're significant. That's why we have to privilege the male-female unions, not because we hate gay people. We love homosexual people, all right? We love them. This is why marriage exists. This is why it has a very special place. Because we care about people, we care about the family, we care about children.
I'm hearing it reframed these days. I'm hearing it reframed, a child deserves a mother and a father. And if you look at that reframing, then people agree with it no matter where they are on the spectrum.
Children deserve a mother and a father. All right, that's what it's all about. And that makes a lot of sense, I think, once you wrap your head around the logic of the argument. The other aspect of the question is, am I Catholic if I don't believe all that? All right. Well, yeah, canonically speaking, the church recognizes people as Catholic because they were baptized in the church, received their sacraments in the church. When you say, I love my faith, but, you know, I disagree with X, Y, and Z, well, you're not a Catholic who loves your faith. You're a Catholic who loves perhaps part of your faith, all right? Part of your faith. Why do I have to go to Mass? Why do I have to believe in the divine authority, the sacred magisterium? Well, because Christ instituted them. If it's Jesus that you're in love with, I mean, if you're a Catholic, he's the center. Then we need to follow what Jesus taught. Jesus taught a lot about human sexuality in Matthew chapter 19. He taught a lot about the magisterium in Matthew 16. He taught a lot about going to Mass when he said, do this in memory of me. It's a divine command to celebrate the liturgy. So if we love Christ, we need to follow his teaching.
Let's take one more from Sheila in Florida, listening on Sirius XM 130.
My question is in reference to the comment about the children being raised by gays, that they're being deprived of a parent. Well, what about the ones that do get to see the other parent? And like in my son's case, him and his partner, my son's raising his two children, and they see the mother every week. They spend 1 week with my son and his partner and another week with the mother. And they go to Catholic school. my son and his partner are paying for the Catholic school. But also, what about the children who are orphans, or the gay couples that adopt children?
Sure, sure.
That have no parents.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. So yeah. Let me give you an analogy. All right. People in nature, normatively, according to the kind of the construction of the human body, are due in nature two eyes. If somebody is deprived of an eye through no fault of their own, they certainly have done nothing wrong. That's regrettable. It's sad that they need two eyes. They got to have that, perspective. Got to be able to
depth perception
and so forth. No. They need them. All right. They lack one. That's a real shame. That's a real shame. They haven't done anything wrong by losing an eye. But if I said, you know what, you haven't done anything wrong for losing an eye, so I'm going to go gouge out your eye. Well, then I would have done something very wrong, because I would be depriving that child of something that he was due in nature. Right. Mm-hmm. So a child who, through no fault of his own, loses a parent to divorce or even, whatever. Right? Child hasn't done anything wrong, but someone who says, you know what, I don't think you need that second eye. I don't think you need that biological parent. So I'm going to make that judgment call, and I'm going to deprive you of what you're due in nature. Well, the adult who makes that judgment call in the life of the child is depriving the child of something that they deserve. And that adult is doing something objectively wrong to that child. To be sure, if a child is deprived of a parent through death or divorce, it's better that they have access to that parent, you know, a little rather than none. But, I mean, I'm a father. I have five kids. Do my children deserve me one day a week, one day a month, one day a year? Or do they deserve my total self-donation, the complete offering of my life, to lay it down for them like Christ gave his life for the church? My blood, my sweat, my tears, my money, my sacrifice, my all that I would give for the life and the soul and the salvation of my children. Of course, because they're infinitely worthy, they deserve all of me. And my wife deserves all of me, not part of me, not one day a week, not one day a month. Now, better that I give them one day a week than no day a week, but that hardly justifies withdrawing myself from their life for 6 days out of seven. Hardly justifies that. I'm glad that your grandchildren, is that right?
Yeah.
I'm glad that they have access to their mother one day a week. Would that they had her whole life. Would that they had her whole life.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense to you, Sheila?
It makes perfect sense in a healthy relationship like you have with your wife, but some other couples don't have that. And
that doesn't justify.
So I understand. I'm Catholic, and I understand everything you're saying, and it's something I deal with, you know, because I'm Catholic. I go to church every Sunday. I went to Catholic school. So it's something I have to deal with emotionally every day of my life.
Sure,
Sheila, I have married homosexual friends that are Catholic, and I mean people who are married to members of the opposite gender, okay, give up their own sexual inclination for the good of their children. So we are all called to make sacrifices.
Thank you for listening to the audio recording provided by St. Paul Street Evangelization. We hope you have enjoyed it. If this presentation has helped you in your walk with God, or if you have more questions, please visit our website at www.streetevangelization.com or call 657-777-2963. You can also become a member of St. Paul Street Evangelization and access hundreds of other free resources that will help you respond to Pope Francis's call to the new evangelization. You can also make a tax-deductible donation to support our street teams and the distribution of information on the Catholic faith. Thank you for listening, and may God bless you and your family.